So, Barbara Knudsen, you are back from Turkey. When were you over there?
In May. We were there from just the very beginning of May into early June. We were there about almost 6 weeks altogether.
And how did it happen that you were called to go over there?
The project was sponsored by the Rotary Club. So Wilfred Pimentel, who's a Californian and very active in Rotary International, had been in communication with a Turkish man who's very active in Rotary there, who is an American-trained engineer, and had been interested in solar cooking and had been talking, had been in touch with Wilfred Pimentel for a number of years, 3 or 4 years, I think, trying to gather up the support and the resources and so on to try to do a project on solar cooking in Turkey. So when they were when it became fairly clear that this was going to happen, then they wanted to have someone who'd had some experience in training women to do in the basics of solar cooking. And they asked me if I would be willing, be interested in doing that. And it sounded right away as if it would be interesting and fun to do. I'd been to Turkey a couple of times before, and had, very fond of the place. And so I was really pleased to have the chance to go.
And what is your experience with solar cooking and women?
Well, I'm a retired university professor and taught at the University of Minnesota's International Studies Center for many years. During that time, the main things that I taught and worked on were issues around international development of the poor countries of the world. And as the feminist movement grew stronger over those years, I became particularly interested in the roles of women. So that was principally what I taught and wrote about during the last a couple of decades of my university life. At the end of that time, I already had come to know a little bit about solar cooking, kind of accidentally, but had about the time that I left, I went on the board of Solar Cookers International and was a board member at the time that they made the decision to first start actually doing some projects overseas. So I had been a part of their first project overseas in the refugee camp in the northern part of Kenya. Kenya is another place that I know very well, because with my family and I lived there when my kids were quite small, and they're now grown up and have given me grandchildren. So it's been a long time, and I've been back to Kenya 10, 12 times since that time, sometimes taking students, sometimes on a small research project, and so on. So I went to Kenya, and we stayed 3 months that first time studying the first large project that Solar Cookers International did in a refugee camp. And I'd been back many times working on that one. I participated in starting the one in Dadaab and wrote the project for the Zimbabwe project and so on. So I had done a lot of training of women in the camps. And while these are different women, we hadn't done a big project of this kind outside of camps. So this is far and away the biggest project that SCI's had any connection to. And there wasn't a formal connection with SCI, except that I was a board member.
Okay. And how big are those projects in the Kenyan refugee camps?
Sorry, say that one more time?
Yeah, how big are those projects in the Kenyan refugee camps?
Well, in the Kenyan refugee camps, we started out there in January of 1995. So we've been more than 6 years there. And when we went out there, we didn't have a clue what we were going to find, what we were going to do. I had gone out to the camp for 2 weeks in the fall of the previous year out there, just kind of to look around and to sort of case the place, see what it was like, what the facilities were, what we'd have to bring in, what we could get there, and so on. Well, it's a very isolated place. We could get almost nothing. We had to bring in everything we needed. And we put together a plan then afterwards in conjunction with Bev Bloom, who was the executive director of SCI at that time. put together a plan, but, you know, we didn't really know how well it was going to work or anything. So, you know, they had been, SEI had been doing training people, had been doing training workshops, but always with people who spoke English and so on. So we went out there. About 2 days later, we did a first workshop, and we did a trial-run workshop with staff of the refugee camp and a small representation of women who, of refugee women. They were maybe two-thirds staff people and about a third refugee women, to sort of see, you know, how the cooker worked in that climate. And Kahuma is almost directly on the equator in the bottom of the Rift Valley, so the climate is, you know, just absolutely perfect. It's sunny most of the year, very brief periods of rainy periods, but sometimes it doesn't even rain during the rainy periods. And once in a while, it'll have an absolute downpour, and, you know, we're doing actually a lot of damage because the area is, they call it semi-arid, but it's about as close to a desert as you find anywhere. So we tried this out, and it worked. We did some adjustment, and then the camp itself is made up of lots of different ethnic groups. So we decided we would train people by ethnic group. That seemed, they lived by ethnic group. So we decided right away that we wanted to train people in groups of people who live close to one another, so they could be helpful to one another as they proceeded learning how to solar cook after we'd given them the initial training. That proved to be a very wise thing to do. And then we just, you know, that was just kind of gut-level feeling on our part, that was a smart thing to do. Often these projects go in and try to find the leaders' wives or something like that, on the idea of kind of opinion leaders who, if they'll do something, then others will follow them. We decided that wasn't the way to go. We rather just wanted ordinary women, but women who were neighbors to one another. So we'd get people who lived within a couple of houses of one another. We started out with groups of 12, and we did two-day workshops. Everything had to be translated, sometimes twice, actually. So I had done a lot of this training. I mean, I had all that memorized. And that's 5-6 years ago, and I'd done some of it over all that time. So we went to Turkey with the materials. We had refined the materials over and over and over in that period of time. SEI, for example, had created visuals that accompany the training to explain the point. And those are all completely without words, so that they can be used with any language group. So we had really good materials to work with. We put together training plans in Turkey, went out and had the same reaction that we'd had in the camp the first time. They brought together a group of women in a little elementary school in a small town about 20 miles from the city where we were headquartered.
And how were these women chosen?
They were women who were associated with this elementary school, and I think they just sent out word through their network. The little town is a town of about 5,000, so it's a little community, and there are two elementary schools. The town is kind of spread out, divided by a river, so there's an elementary school on each side, and so they're not huge elementary schools. I think they had two shifts of about 150 kids in each. So they just sent out word with the kids and parents, and they had a parent group of some kind, and, you know, those were women they knew. So the first day we had maybe 30 or 40 women came to hear what we were going to talk about. And we just, you know, told them a little bit about solar cooking, and that it was, in fact, possible to cook with the sun and so on, and they all kind of nodded and looked a little unbelieving, and we said that we could take 12 people to train on the following Monday. And there's a woman. I mean, you never understand quite all of who's who in this, but the Rotary itself has a group of people whom they call Rotaract. And that's it's kind of an auxiliary, and there are people who are not members of Rotary but who help on Rotary projects. And there was a Rotaract woman in this town who didn't have children in the school, but who was a kind of a major volunteer in helping in the school. She took this project on as kind of what she would do. She lined up the women, asked who wanted to come, you know, who was convenient to come on that those particular days, and so on. So that was all done for us by essentially by the staff of this elementary school. And we operated all the time in this little school and a little schoolyard, which was in itself, you know, it was very nice. It was fun. It must have been quite distracting to the school, because when we would arrive in the morning, you know, the whole school kind of kids were. There'd be some on the playground. You know, they all rush over, all wanted to say good morning to us, and they all brought us flowers from home. And I'm sure the school was quite glad to see us go, actually, because we must have been distracting. But it worked well. The school, obviously, in that town was a kind of a community center. Had a little building that had a little stove and stuff where the teachers had, kind of faculty lounge or teacher's lounge. And the school people had meetings there and so on. So I think the school made that kind of an attempt to be a kind of part of the community. The principal of the school was a Rotarian. That was, I suppose, the original connection. So they found the people. So we started then on we had a day of training. And then we had actually terrible luck. So then we had 11 days of rain.
Mm.
Which is very unusual in that time, in this time of year. And they kept saying, oh, this is so odd. This shouldn't be happening. And we said, oh, dear. Well, finally, the sun came out again. And from that point on, the weather was perfect all the time. So we picked up our training and kind of reviewed what we'd said on the first day. And on the first day, they cook. Women cook there while we're there. I mean, we cook. We have some food. They prepare it. Put it in the cookers, we put it out in the yard and cook it, and we have it for lunch, and they go home having eaten solar cooked food, which they've prepared, but under our direction.
And what was their reaction to that?
Well, that's the same the world over. The first time they open the pot and see the food is cooked, you know, they almost get, you know, they giggle and they laugh, and they say, oh, that can that be, you know, and they're just, it's really one of the most fun things, is to see people who've never seen it before open the pot and see cooked beans or tomatoes or, you know, an eggplant dish or whatever that we made, bread sometimes and so on. And nearly all of them, you know, turn out perfectly. Once in a while, you have one that doesn't work, and we say, well, you know, does everything always turn out right for you at home? And they say, no. Mm-hmm. So we say, well, you know, same way here. So then on the second day of our training, then they bring things from home and cook them there also. I mean, they also cook there, but they have prepared the food themselves. So it's their own food, cooked to their own tastes and so on. They prepare them there. And we kind of go over the training again. You know, we mimic. We have them demonstrate to one another and so on. And they go out. We go out and check the cookers and check the orientation to the sun. And you know, we have a kind of standard protocol and why we should do this. And we relate it to the environmental movement around the world. We don't highlight that, but we do a little bit of that because we think it's important that they know that they're also part of a larger movement of people who are doing things to try to help to save our climate and our environment. So, I mean, that's not their major motivation. So then, after those 2 days, then about 2 or 3 days later, we make a visit to each of them in their homes. And this was the Pimentels and I did that, and we laughed about that because on that day, luckily for us, a couple of them had cooked together, had taken two cookers and put them on someone's roof or in someone's yard, because every one of them wanted us to eat with them. So on that one day, we had trained 9 people. We had 9 lunches on that day.
Oh,
and we sort of went rolling home, you know, unable to eat another mouthful.
So they had been using the cookers in between.
Yeah, they were using the cookers. They were planning the things, and they're wonderful cooks. Turkish food is unusually good, I think. The cuisine is just excellent. And it also... is very appropriate for solar cooking because it's heavily vegetable stuff, which just works very nicely in the long, slow cooking. They like eggplant, they like tomatoes, onions, there's lots of things of that sort together with little spices. And then they make chicken. And their favorite, everybody's favorite, though, always were these grape leaves that they make rice with, sometimes a little meat in it or sometimes just flavoring in the rice and wrapped up in a grape leaf and then cooked in the solar cooker. Mm. And it's just wonderful. Everybody just loved it.
So what is the advantage for these women, aside from being part of this ecological movement?
Well, their real motive, and this is the first time that I hadn't given much thought to this, actually, until we got there. I had sort of made the assumption that they were going to be, that they cooked with wood or charcoal, but they don't. Wood, and the cooking with wood and cooking with charcoal has been gone for about 30 years in Turkey. And they cook with bottled gas. So they have kitchens with mm-hmm. bottled gas, little, like you put on, like we have in our barbecues.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they have inside their kitchens, like more or less like that. And they come, they are delivered to the house once a month or however often they need it or they call them. So it's quite convenient. But Turkey has no fossil fuels of any kind itself. So all of its fossil fuels from which that stuff is derived are imported. And Turkey's economy has been absolutely in free fall for the last two or three years, well, longer than that, but even worse in the last couple of years. And actually, while we were there, the cost of those canisters that will last people close to a month for a kind of small family, maybe two kids, would be something, used to be around $5. While we were there, it was 10 or 11, and by the time we left, it was 13, and now the last letter I had, they said it was 15.
How does that compare?
These women that we worked with in Turkey, the whole thing is really different than most of the solar cooking projects in other parts of the world, because these people bought the cookers. I mean, this wasn't a giveaway. They bought them. They are women whose husbands have jobs. They're kind of what we would call working class people. They're not really middle class people. They're not people with educations, most of them. High school some, but some not even that. And some of the women, a few of our women, were not literate. Couldn't read at all. But their kids went to school and they had pretty decent houses. And they had, you know, some money. But this was eating so into their household budget, the cost of fuel, that people were being unable to buy food because they had to spend so much on fuel. Even these sort of working class women were really being harmed by that. So their motive was essentially economic.
So how would you compare the cost of the cooker for them with the cost of a bottle of gas for a month?
Well, you see, we had those cookers when about the second day we arrived. I was actually there. I mean, I was there a few days before the Pimentels, and Mr. Paksoy, Abdullah Paksoy, and I went to visit a cardboard manufacturer, and he said he could make them for us, and he started stamping out our cookits almost immediately. We had brought in some cookits to work with, but he said he could make them, and he makes them for equivalent of $1.47.
Well, is that lined with aluminum foil also?
Well, yeah, and so we sold them to the women. We didn't want to sell them just at that cost because we wanted to establish a precedent that would work, because we knew that eventually we were going to train women to train others. And in order to do that, to have an incentive to do that, they need to make a little money off that. So we charged, I think, $4 for the cookers. That left money to buy food for your demonstration so that the women could do that. And a little bit of money left over for them to have about $1 per person whom they trained and sold a cooker to. So it wasn't big money, but they could have 10 women, find 10 women, have it do a thing, sell them 10 cookers, and she'd make $10 for that.
So it might cost
a lot of money in that for them.
It might cost them about 2 weeks' worth of gas to buy their cooker.
Yeah, maybe. They would the cooker. You know, these women all had some small amounts of disposable income. One of the women we trained didn't, and Will and Marie and I put a little money in so she could have a cooker. But she didn't have it. She was a widow. She didn't have the money. So these were women who were kind of close to the margin, but not like the camps. Nothing like the camps.
So what percentage, during a good season, what percentage of their of gas do you think they could save using these cookers? Like if their bottle lasts them a month, how long could that bottle last them?
Well, if the bottle would last a month, that was $15. So if you paid $3 for this thing and you could cook on it for a year, well, you've saved quite a lot of money.
Right. I mean, do you think they could do 50%?
They probably could save half the bottle of gas.
Okay, so they could save like $7 a month.
Yeah,
so
they could save like $7-$8 a month.
So the payback period is less than a month.
Oh yeah, less than a month for sure.
And do they get any other gains from not having to
we talked to them about that. Bottled gas is a relatively clean thing, and it's relatively safe and so on. But one of the things that they came and they said, Barbara, you know what we discovered? Our kitchens stay so cool now. Because we were there when it was approaching pretty hot. And they had not realized how much of the heat in their houses. Their houses tend to be made out of cement block. They're mostly two-story cement block houses with a flat top, and they cook up on top, where the sun up on the they dry their clothes, and do their cooking up on their flat roof. But when they were cooking inside, if you were cooking, say, a pot of beans, which had to go for 2-3 hours, then you had generated a lot of heat in your kitchen, and because that hadn't occurred to me that was one to think of that as an advantage. It's a different advantage than what we'd use in the camps, because in the camps the advantages are really around, for example, the pots are clean, they aren't sooty, and there's no fire to worry for your kids to be harmed by, and there's no smoke and so on. There's not a lot of problem with gas like that in the house, although everybody'd be better off if they didn't cook with bottled gas inside their house. Probably. There is a certain amount of stuff that comes with any kind of combustion of that sort. But none of those are big problems. So theirs was mostly money, but then they all came and they said how much they liked to have a cool kitchen.
Do you think there'll be any problems with husbands wanting to tell their wives how they're supposed to cook?
Well, there weren't. We went on to all the houses, and of course the husbands always came out and talked to us and so on. And there was not a sign, not a hint of anything like that. We had that in the camps all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That was a routine thing in the camp that the husband would say, is my wife supposed to do things the way I want her to do them? But I didn't see anything like that in Turkey. I think, there's another piece of this, Tom, that was interesting that I hadn't thought about this either. When I'd been in Turkey before, one of the things you're struck traveling in Turkey is the number of places where they use solar collectors to heat water. Virtually every apartment building in the whole of Turkey, from one end to the other, has solar collectors on the rooftops. The sun is very hot there. They're not photovoltaics. They're just plain old collectors. Just, tubing that the water goes through and runs, and that's enough to heat the water there. So, and then it occurred to me one time, because a few people would say, you can't cook food with the sun. I know better than that. I said, now, wait a minute. I said, do you heat your water with the sun? And she'd say, well, yes, of course I heat my water with the sun. I said, well, then why wouldn't you think you can cook with it? Oh, she'd say. And I think maybe that would have been something men would have done, almost certainly, had those solar collectors put on their roofs. Maybe they were already sort of, thinking along those lines and saying, well, this is another addition to what you can do with the sun's energy.
That's a good point. They'd probably be more open to it.
It wasn't a real foreign idea to them once you kind of pointed it out, but it didn't occur to me for a while, actually. So And that we had a lot of. It was really, they're very nice people. The Turkish hospitality is legendary in the world, I think. You know, you will not go by a Turkish person's house and say hello to them without coming in and having tea, because they just insist on it. They're just so very nice about that. And I always had a laugh when I met a really old man walking down, and the man said he'd really like to have a solar cooker because he was very poor and he didn't have enough money to buy gas. And I said, well, you know, you have to come to one of our classes, and we'd be really glad to have you come to class. And these are very cheap, and I'm sure you can afford it. He said, I don't know that I can afford that. I can afford $3 or whatever the money was in Turkish. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. I pointed his hair and mine. I said, since you and I, we're going to have a senior citizen discount here. And we all laughed about it, and they all tried to translate that to him, and then he laughed. And people, they're just the nicest, warmest kind of people. And then, you know, Tom, we stayed with families while we were there. Now, you know, 6 weeks is a long time to stay with a family. I mean, I was, I thought, if there was anything I worried about going, it was that, sort of imposing yourself on a family for 6 weeks. But at the end of it, the Pimentels and I had a little party for everybody who worked, you know, who had helped us so much with this project. And, you know, we stood up, and each one of us said a little, our thanks, you know, and I said, you know, I was really nervous. It's a long time to stay in the family. And the family that I stayed with, she stood up and she said, no, it's too short. Don't go home. Stay longer. Come back. You know, they were so nice to us that it was, they made the whole thing just a wonderful experience. Now, this Paksoy, Abdullah Paksoy, is a really unusual man. He's did an engineering degree at Cornell. His wife is a professor at the local university there, and the assistant rector of that university, and she is a biochemist, something like that. She's a scientist, and they have two very nice kids, and they obviously have a lot of money. The family is influential in the community. And he could just lift his finger and bring together any resources that we needed, whether that was translators or transportation or a different kind of bag or whatever we needed, he could find it. And he's just a man who's extremely hardworking and just gets an enormous amount done on any one day. He was supervising construction projects in cities 60 miles away from the town we lived in, city we lived in. So he'd go back and forth to those a couple times a week, but he still was always there to be helpful to us.
So what has happened there since you were there then during the summer?
Well, I think there's a problem with the way the Rotary works, I think. Rotary has a system in which they give money for pilot projects, and that's what this was a pilot project. Now, because they'd raised a fair amount of money, it could be a pretty good-sized pilot project, as we trained, 100 people while we were there. But then, after this pilot project, then you write a proposal to Rotary International for the project. But that means that you have, from the time you do the pilot until, they haven't yet decided on that, but that money is to become available in January now. So it's from June to January. You have to kind of see if you can kind of keep something going, fan the ashes a little bit to keep the project going, but without additional resources. So Abdullah has, I think, you know, pulled together small resources to keep it going so that the people have continued, our trainers. I didn't ever finish that, actually. After we trained them, and then we brought the most enthusiastic ones back and did a day of training of them to train others.
Mm.
And then we visited them as they trained others each time. We sat in and watched them doing the training. And then we critiqued, and we said, maybe it'd be better if you do this, and so on. So we had this, then we left a group of people, about 30 women, who were trainers. And then Abdullah has found, I mean, they're still working in their own community. Our projections were that they could they could have covered about half of that of the community that they lived in by the time the money came again, working at a kind of slow pace, and not with not much remuneration, just kind of minimal remuneration, because there just wasn't very much money left by the time it was all done. And Abdullah was trying to raise more, but Turkey's in such a bad shape that it's hard. But anyway, those, they've done. And then they've also done special demonstrations in a few other places where they think, where they'd like then to start projects similar to what we started in their small town. Just replicate the project itself in other towns around Adana, the city. This is about 20 miles from Adana. They've done a couple of special populations. There's, for example, one place in the city that the Rotary had started, which is a special school for handicapped kids. And since those kids can't travel alone, there are school buses, and they bring them, but the mother comes with them. So the mother is at this school all day, or half the day. I mean, a school day, but it's like a 10 to 2 or something. So they trained those women to solar cook, and then they started doing their solar cooking while the kids were in school. Then they'd carry their food home. So they were doing some special projects of that kind. But when the money comes, then the plan is to do this replication. And I think Abdullah actually has some larger scale projects, you know, I mean, like trying to do this with Rotary clubs all over Turkey, and maybe even other parts of the Middle East, all of where the sun is, you know, during all that part of the world, the climate is really good for this kind of purpose. In the oil-rich countries, it you know, it isn't really necessary, but because they have so much fuel. But that's going to change at some point in the not too distant future. So it would be very smart if they would begin to think along these lines at least.
Great.
So it's a very interesting it's an interesting part of the world. Turkey doesn't have wonderful relationships with its Middle Eastern neighbors, but it doesn't have really bad ones either. And I think commercially there's a lot of exchange. We were 50 miles from the border with Syria. And we went to that town on the Syrian border one time, and which is kind of sort of different in character than most of the rest. In fact, Syria claims it, still claims the town. But there's a lot of, you buy Syrian goods there, and the Syrians buy a lot of Turkish goods there. So there's obviously a lot of industrial and, you know, business exchange with them. Political is a little more delicate, but I think Abdullah could probably manage to start doing something like that in at least some of the other Middle Eastern countries.
Hmm.
It has potential, I think.
Great. I wanted to ask you about SHE. Is that your organization?
Yeah, SHE, Solar Household Energy, Inc.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we, three of us started that a couple of years ago, and we finally got nonprofit status. Because of things like this project in Turkey, actually, people in Turkey wrote to SCI and said, you know, we really need some volunteer trainers to come out here. And SCI wrote back and, you know, said, you know, boy, I mean, we're just up to our ears in project. We really haven't got we don't have a consulting service or a core of volunteers. And Abdullah wrote back, and he said, well, could I just put an ad in your little newsletter, in your SCI newsletter thing, and then see who might, if I could find a volunteer to come? And then SCI wrote back and said, no, we don't want you to do that, because then you might not get someone who knows what they're doing. Well, then Abdullah got really cross about it. He said, what the heck are you doing anyway? You won't help me at all. What's your purpose if you're on here to help people get started? And that then Ramon in the office down there, Kevin Coyle, called me and said, Barbara, would you think about doing this? And I said, well, yeah, I guess I could. And so, you know, it was that kind of idea that SCI had gotten so busy with all of their big projects, which I, you know all too well, that they really weren't able to do to give the kind of technical help to other groups that might want to get started on things. So what we think of ourselves as is being people who are able to help people get started doing things, giving them help in project design, probably something SEI doesn't do very well, in my opinion, is to do much evaluation, really good evaluations of their projects, and provide sort of consulting on on the training, on getting that started.
I know we
one
have.
Of the other people in the organization is one of the other men is another very skilled trainer. She's a better trainer than I am. She's even more skilled, and she's decided that she speaks French, so she can work all over West Africa as well. So that we are kind of consultants to people who want to get started. There's another difference between us and SEI also. That's the main difference, is that we don't think of running projects. We're not going to run projects. We just would provide help to people who want to, and it was something SEI wasn't doing. But the other difference is that and SEI is not opposed to this, but it's not been their method of operating just because of starting in the refugee camp, which is different. Our sense is that this has to get firmly rooted into the marketplace. That no organization has the money to give stoves away to all the poor people in the world. So we have to try to find ways, cheap enough devices and so on, that people can afford them, and that entrepreneurs will have an incentive to start making them. And devices at a range of levels for people in different income levels. Certainly some ones for the poor, that would certainly always be our main hope, that we would be able to get those things started, because that's where the biggest problem is, but also for working and middle-class people as well. So we're heavily oriented towards trying to bring manufacturers and distributors and sellers and so on into this system, as well as the nonprofit organization. We need nonprofits too, because places like refugee camps, well, if you don't have any income, then what are you supposed to do? They don't have an income.
Right.
Although you still can always ask yourself, and I always do on this, how is it then that everybody smokes?
Are they smoking in the refugee camps?
Oh, they all smoke.
Oh, boy.
And in any refugee camp that I've ever been in, there's always a thriving little business district. Coffee houses, bakeries, little stores that sell, cameras, film, cigarettes, jean jackets, boom boxes. That's amazing. The economy of a refugee camp is a mystery to everyone, I think. But there is some money that circulates around in it. People bring some money. Probably some people have a little, some little maybe black market or something, business on the side. And there are people who work for the camp, and they have an income.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a little income, and it starts more income. People start a little business, and that generates a little. But it's hard to understand.
So I know we have a link to your website on the Solar Cooking Archive. It's solarcooking.org. Do you know? Can you tell us what your URL is for your site?
What
don't you have a website for your SHE for she?
I haven't even looked at it in the last little while.
Oh, okay. Then I'll just point
it's
everybody.
Very
to...
Very simple. We've never really spent much time developing it. Actually,
I see. Okay.
We spent so much time trying to get our 501c3. And I don't think we do have a website, but I think it's just a couple pages, Tom. I don't think it's going to be anything.
But people could, I can point people to it from the Solar Cooking Archive, and they could go there and donate if they'd like
to. Yeah,
sure,
and it has the addresses and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, is there anything else I haven't asked you that you should be telling us?
Well, I don't, this is on a slightly different topic, but you may want to start asking somebody about this. We're trying to figure out what to do about Afghanistan, too.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's going to result in, but I think probably it'll result in something. The SEI board is just, we're going to find some way to make the situation in Afghanistan. That was that we were some, people are kind of looking for stuff to send us now. said that Afghanistan, like 15 years ago, it had 5% of its land was covered, had forest cover. Now it's, 3% of its land had forest cover, which isn't very much to start with. I mean, it's hardly any. Now it's 0.5%.
Hmm.
And they estimate that by 2005 there will not be any. And 100% of the people cook with wood. There isn't any other fuel except, you know, the well-to-do people in cities.
Mm-hmm.
So what in the world? What are they supposed to do with all that? I mean, what are you going to do with all this wheat we're trekking in there?
Yeah.
It's a, you know, it just seems to me to be so obvious that somebody's got to do something about that.
It's probably going to happen in the springtime, though, I would imagine.
Yeah, I would. I think probably nothing much is going to happen. But what our idea always was that we would try to, you know, just tag on to some other refugee organization. That's kind of the tack we're taking. Tack on to some other refugee organization that's working in the camps. Get started. Get people, you know, get Afghan people, women trained in the camps, and then they, as they go home, can be the seed that makes this thing move inside the country.
And probably the fireless cooking or retained heat cooking where you stick the pot.
It would be wonderful.
Like even during the winter now, they could heat the pot up on a wood fire and then set it inside an insulated box.
No question.
Just let it cook.
One of the problems, of course, is that in at least a lot of the country, they need heat so badly also, and then
that's
the solar
true.
Cooking doesn't help. And of course, that's why you're so wanting a fire, which you can understand.
That's true.
But at some point, there just isn't going to be any. And I don't really know how anybody's, who's thinking about the country's energy needs, which certainly are right up there along with its food needs.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You can't eat raw wheat.
No.
So it's a really interesting thing. You may want to stay in touch with us on that one
as
that develops, because that's going to be, you know, if that comes out, a local organization here in Minneapolis, a refugee organization, just got permission to work on the Iran side. So they're going to start setting up refugee services on the on the western side of Afghanistan, where there's also a ton of refugees. Iran has as many refugees as Pakistan, but we don't hear anything about them because no Western organizations have ever been in there.
Well, we'll have to talk again after there's some developments here. We'll have another interview in 6 months or so, and you can tell us what's happening.
Yeah, this agency has, they're just back from a first negotiating trip, and a field group is going out now next month, and they expect to start there in the spring. They're, you know, kind of resigned to not being able to get much done until spring. But I think it's going to be a long, cold winter for people.
Yeah.
Terrible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
Barbara,
keep your ears open for that. We'll let you know when we have something to tell you.
Well, thank you very much for all the information you gave us, and we'll have this interview up on the internet.
I appreciate your interest, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.